Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. Today's show is, as always, very informative and very inspiring and very enlightening, but it's also, I want to warn you, very frightening. The subject matter is even scarier than John Carpenter's Halloween, anything he could come up with, but please do listen. We have two guests. Our first guest is Don DeBar. Don DeBar is a producer at CPRMetro.org, our engineer for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and a very dedicated peace and social justice activist. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Don DeBar. And after Don, I'll be interviewing Harvey Wasserman about the cataclysm at Fukushima. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Don. Don DeBar, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, I told people in the introduction that you are producer at CPR Metro and the engineer for Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, but you're also far more than that. You're a peace and social justice activist and obviously also a media activist, alternative media activist.
Yeah, the... I guess the sequence that these things happened to me kind of explains it. I was a peace and justice activist before I got involved in media. Mm-hmm. From high school, I came up with the folks that in the 60s and early 70s, that I graduated high school in 1972, so we were protesting the Vietnam War. We were in favor of and active working on civil rights and racial and gender equality and all of the things that people were fighting for then. And I never really let go of it. And then in the late 70s, I got enticed into a TV studio for public access TV station here in Westchester County, New York, and learned how to do television production. I was a musician the whole time for all of that, so I kind of learned a little bit about recording and stuff, being involved with music. So from there, I saw TV and other media as like, wow, I could really do some activism here. So I kind of dove in with both feet in the late 70s, and I've been busy with that ever since. I got dragged into WBAI in the late 90s, early 2000s, by Errol Maitland, who was a morning engineer and producer, and also was a co-producer of a Wake Up Call, which was a drive-time morning program on WBAI, and Bernard White, who was one of the hosts of that and ultimately the program director there. And they had me doing first regional stuff. They would do a regional roundup from the suburbs of New York City, and I was doing the Hudson Valley, and ultimately I became the news producer for the morning show.
So what's going on at Pacifica Radio right now? I mean, there's obviously some pretty profound problems and issues.
Yeah, WBAI is the New York station, and it is at the moment about to be spun off. There's a request for proposals that was issued by Pacifica earlier this month, where they're actually seeking somebody to take over the station and run it, and maybe at they're leasing it, essentially, and then maybe at the end of some period of time in the future, they'll take it back. There was a takeover of WBAI. Let me back out of that for a minute. The Pacifica Radio has five stations, like company stores, five that owns directly. That's KPFK in Los Angeles, KPFA in the Bay Area in California, KPFT in Houston, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and WBAI in New York. There actually is no separate entity, WBAI, KPFA, KPFK. There's Pacifica Radio. They own the licenses in those five stations. And then there are 100, 200 affiliate stations. These are actually independent radio stations around the country that enter into a relationship with Pacifica and carry some of their programming. The costs for the New York station are, well, the costs for any radio station involve real estate costs for the studios, also rental for the highest point in town that you can find to put your antenna on top of it so that you can broadcast, and of course personnel to staff the station, engineers, management people, paid producers, and there are also volunteer producers at Pacifica. And they rely primarily on listener contributions, listener donations. They get about 20% maybe of their money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but the balance of it comes from donations from listeners. WBAI for many years was the brought in the most money out of all of the five stations. And in late 90s, 2000, there was a takeover of Pacifica by a group mostly allied with the Clinton faction of the Democratic Party, including Mary Frances Berry and others. And while they were wreaking havoc with the programming and doing other things that almost destroyed the network at the time, one of the things that they did was sign a lease for 15 years with Larry Silverstein, who's the same guy that used to own the net leases on the World Trade Center, to lease studios at 120 Wall Street, some of the most expensive real estate in New York City, and that's saying something. And they moved the station into there in 1997, early 1998. The lease was structured in a way that the rent went up sharply after an initial tease rate, and there was a point in time when WBAI, which was flush with cash and actually subsidizing the rest of the network in terms of its income against its expenses, started to go into the red. It was almost solely a consequence of this lease, which appreciated sharply about 7-8 years ago. There were two factions, there have been really two or three factions in Pacifica generally, that tug of war back and forth for control of the network and of the individual stations. You could say they're probably represented by, on the one hand, a group that favors community-based programming, that is inclusive of a good solid number of black and brown folks as producers and as actual self-motivated managers and staff, and on the other hand, those that prefer to appeal to a wider audience, prefer like health programming to political programming, and such. Those two factions across the network kind of been mud wrestling for control of Pacifica over the years, and in 2007-2008 the governance structure, which involves elections in this membership foundation Pacifica by people who are eligible to vote because they donated in the period that the election's being conducted in.
Right.
There was a lawsuit around the election and some money introduced into it where with glossy flyers and a real racist campaign against some of the managers, the black managers in particular, that led to this white, for lack of a better word, this white group taking over Pacifica in 2007-2008. And although they had taken control of the Pacifica National Board and had taken control of some of, I think, most of the local station boards, which are the elected structure of Pacifica, there was still an executive director with a contract who had been hired by the previous group, and so things looked the same more or less for a few months. Apparently, they made her life, the former executive director, unpleasant enough that she finally resigned. And when she resigned, under California law, because Pacifica is a membership corporation, the person that was the head of the Pacifica National Board, the chair of the advisory board, became by operation of law also the executive director of Pacifica. And that was Grace Aaron from KPFK in Los Angeles. Grace Aaron comes from a background as an activist in the Church of Scientology.
Wow.
She is what you call, what she calls, a shunned fundamentalist. She believes that the Church of Scientology, or she says, I mean, there's a YouTube video of her going into this in detail, that she believes the Church of Scientology has wandered from the mission of L. Ron Hubbard, and consequently has some issues with some of the teachings and practices that they conduct now. As a consequence, apparently she was subject to this, I don't know what procedure, practice called shunning by the Church of Scientology. But then she is basically philosophically based within Scientology. And she decided that, that she was going to do Clean House across Pacifica. Now, WBAI financed itself primarily from listener donations, and the cash comes in that way. They would have a spring fund drive, a summer fund drive, a fall fund drive, and a winter fund drive, and in between, not much money comes in. And Pacifica, the financial planning at Pacifica, to my knowledge, which only goes back about maybe 10 years, has never been such that they keep accounts and mitigate cash flow problems by having, you know, like the rent in this account, so that even though we haven't had a fundraiser in 2 months, we still have the money for the rent, then we pay it down like that. Well, instead, at BAI, what they would do is they'd get behind in the rent 1 or 2 months or whatever. The landlord would know, oh, they haven't had a fund drive X in October. They would have the fund drive, they'd catch up the rent, et cetera. In the process of that, mechanically in New York State, and my background is actually in real estate. I've been in the title insurance business for 40 some odd years, and I'm heavily involved. I've been heavily involved in commercial transactions in New York City. I know this stuff inside out. And what happens when the landlord doesn't get the rent at the beginning of the month, they take procedural steps to protect their, you know, to preserve their rights so that they haven't waived any rights. And the process in New York involves sending out what they call a 3-day notice to quit, which is essentially a way of preserving your right to evict somebody 3, 4, 6 months down the line. But it's titled 3-day notice to quit. Well, what happened was they had one of these. Tony Riddle, who was the general manager at WBAI, he used to run the Alliance for Community Media for years, and he's had quite a lot of stature, actually, in the public access television field and in community media generally, internationally. He had made arrangements with the landlord, as they had to do periodically, and was actually paying down the arrears, having received, you know, a little cash from a quick fund drive, when Grace Aaron swooped in holding a copy of a 3-day notice that somebody had apparently sent her, claiming they were 3 days away from eviction. There was an emergency situation that required them to come in and take over, and that the problem was that they weren't receiving enough in listener funding, and that problem was because the programming was bad for the audience in New York. Mm-hmm. That was essentially what they did. That happened. We call it the April Fool's Day coup here. It happened in the early part of April 2009. Now, what had happened actually was a month earlier, and before there was a three-day notice to quit out there, Tony Riddle got a phone call from the people that manage the transmitter at the Empire State Building. All of the, since the World Trade Center came down, it used to be the tallest building in New York, whole New York region. All of the TV and radio antennas were on top of that. When that came down, they moved over to the Empire State Building, which was the next tallest building. It's very expensive, by the way. It's $25,000, $30,000 a month to put your antenna up there. But they have a little closet where they put the equipment that runs the antenna. And then there's a key to that to go in and manage essentially what the source, to select what the source is going to be of what gets broadcast. You know, you dial in some numbers and whatever gets transmitted over those numbers into the box is what goes out over the air. Well, Tony Riddle gets a phone call from the managers at the Empire State Building. Remember, the World Trade Center was knocked down in New York. Now the Empire State Building is the communications building in New York. The security for that building is like the security for the Pentagon. Okay, you cannot willy-nilly walk in there and say, hey, I want to go upstairs and play with the transmitters, because they assume you're, you know, this like it's a homeland security issue, as they call it. So anyway, what had happened was apparently the Grace Aaron and the group out in Berkeley, which is where the Pacific is based, wanted to make arrangements with the Empire State Building to change the locks where the transmitter is based and have the keys sent out to California so that the control of the transmitter would no longer be with the general manager, as is the practice at Pacifica, it has been for decades, but rather would be with Grace Aaron, which means, of course, they wanted to be able to control what went out over the air. Well, instead of changing the locks and sending out a key, this Homeland Security site calls the guy who's the tenant and says, do you know somebody just contacted us to do this? And so they got caught trying to do that. The word went out. It went out over the air. The listeners rallied. As a matter of fact, they had an emergency fund drive the morning that it came out over the air and raised $44,000 in 3 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's where our listeners were at in April of 2009, March of 2009. And when that failed, they came up with this other device. And essentially within a month after April, they had fired Bernard White, who was the program director. And they moved Tony Riddle out of the way because they had instructed him to fire Bernard White, and he said there's no cause. So from there, they took over direct management of the station, and since then, they got rid of a number of the community producers, and they started to they brought back Gary Null, for example, who's on every day now, and at this point, he's on several hours a day. So they spend a lot of time peddling green stuff, blue stuff, books on sexual healing is what they're selling today, this kind of stuff. Yeah. And all of the community-based programming, trying to stop gentrification in Harlem and Bed-Stuy and all these different things. Most of that's gone now. And they've run it down to a point where after the lease expired in December of 2012, they can't even afford to run the station paying almost no rent. They went from paying $35,000 a month to Silverstein for the 120 Wall Street offices, and now are paying, I think, $3,000 a month, and they almost lost the transmitter a couple of times. In addition to that, not only have they completely and totally mismanaged the finances of the network and the station to the point that it's close to bankrupt, to hear them say it. Last year, early this year, we found out that because they hadn't filed with the Department of State in California certain mandatory filings, because they don't know fundamental business things, the corporate charter of Pacifica had actually been revoked, and it was no longer a viable corporation. And that before they got it fixed, somebody found out and incorporated under the name. So Pacifica actually is no longer the Pacifica Foundation. It's now Pacifica Foundation Radio because they lost the name because they mismanaged it so bad. That's a broad description of what's happened. And at this point, because they're not able to carry even the bills to stay on the air, that's what they're saying, they put out this request for proposals for somebody else to come in and take over the station. And we have some suspicions that, in fact, this whole thing has been engineered because there are some people poised to take over who wanted to take it over that can't afford to buy a license and can't afford to operate a 50,000-watt middle-of-the-dial station in metropolitan New York, but are going to piggyback off of Pacifica's license and use it to sell, you know, almost as a an infomercial station, use it to sell health books and other things. That's kind of where we're at right now.
Well, you say you have some suspicions, and you have been investigating it. Mm. You know, you sent me a list of questions that would be helpful to ask you so we can expose this. But yeah. I kind of want to go off the script a little bit.
Go ahead. Yeah, yeah, sure.
And ask a question that kind of has been bugging me for years. You know, when I went to Camp Casey and I became, you know, a cause celeb, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Amy Goodman used to bring me to her fire station or wherever
right.
she was
yeah, yeah, yeah.
broadcasting from. And I'd meet her, the big donors to Pacifica. Or whatever, you know, so I was paraded out to raise more money for Democracy Now or Pacifica, I'm not sure which one it was.
Right.
But literally, Dawn, since 2007, I have been on Democracy Now once for 80 seconds. And does that have anything to do with what you're saying, like the Clintonite wing of the Democratic Party, you know, and more conservative factions have taken over Pacifica?
Yeah, I think that the latter is definitely true. The group that's taken over now has, we went from having, let's say, from having me as a producer, for example, to now having Tom Hartman on the air. Well, you know, we had radical communist, you know, anti-racist activists. I'm a small player in that group. There's some very heavy people in New York that had an awful lot of activity. Bernard White, for example. Bernard White, by the way, and Errol Maitland, who's the other person I mentioned earlier, were the host and producer, along with Sharan Harper, who was executive producer of the morning drive time program Wake Up Call. And Amy Goodman was the morning news person that worked for that program. And Democracy Now! Came from that program. So Bernard got purged, and he got targeted. They conducted a 7-8-year campaign, racist campaign against him. They called him, first of all, they called him a black nationalist and said that he was scaring away the white audience. This is all in writing. This is a guy named Steve Brown, who's a member of the local station board in New York, the WBAI local station board, on and off for the last 8-9 years. And he, in my opinion, is the quarterback of an awful lot of this stuff. And he's, I'm told, used to be business partners with Gary Nell. They had some of his missives that I've read talk about Bernard White, who's a black man about 6'2 and heavy build, beating on his chest, intimidating the small, frail white women in the office with his fist in the air, following a small, like a frail-framed, older white Jewish producer into the bathroom and breathing on the back of his neck to intimidate him while he was at the urinal. This is the kind of imagery that they used. Classic racist imagery. I mean, it's almost like, you know, prison rape fantasies. They talked about Errol Maitland aping him. And so that's going on in the background. They were holding out, I forget, is it KGNU, some radio station like in Colorado or Arizona somewhere, holding it out as a model, saying that the reason it wasn't dysfunctional like WBII was dysfunctional was because it wasn't, as diverse, that the population, yes, they were all white, but they didn't have the divisions because of that they have at WBAI. That was the subtext, and it was stated, actually, but the conceptual subtext behind it was very racist. I can't impute intent to Amy Goodman or anybody for why they have or don't have this voice or that voice on, but I can tell you facts. In 2008, as you know, because I saw you on the road a lot, I followed Cynthia McKinney around for her campaign for president as a Green Party candidate. And I, as you know, produce all this stuff wherever I go. So wherever Cynthia went, I had video, I had sound, I had, all kinds of material. She was the Green Party candidate in 2008. I sent stuff to Democracy Now! Incessantly, and Cynthia's campaign had regular contact. She was on twice for the entire year that she campaigned for president.
Right.
Why is that? This is
Jill Stein in 2012 was on all the time.
I know. I don't understand it. Unless if you think of it in terms of politics, because Jill Stein's politics are quite different from Cynthia McKinney's politics and from your politics.
Absolutely.
So, and from mine, by the way. In addition to that, I was a producer at BAI while I was doing this. I mean, the reason I was doing it is because I was a news producer for the morning show. And so I was sending BAI stuff, and that was going like, from my hand to the air practically. As a matter of fact, I actually was caught up in St. Paul during a police riot for the Republican National Convention in 2008. I walked into a Sears that was near this bridge where everybody was arrested. And I went in to buy tape because I was out of tape while I was following everybody around. And while I was in there, they locked the place down, and they had the police mass outside. So I tried to get out. They wouldn't let me out. I actually called into BAI and went on the air saying, I'm being held illegally, blah, 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 blah. So I had access to BAI. Everything else I sent to Free Speech Radio News, to the news producers up in Berkeley, for the network. None of that stuff. They did, I think, Free Speech Radio News, they had a special election 411 or something it was called, daily election program. I think they featured Cynthia twice.
Mm-hmm.
So and Free Speech Radio News had, basically the principals behind it, Carol Spooner and others that ran that that entity. They're on the other side in this fight. It goes back to the Christmas coup, by the way, because there was a discussion at that time about inserting into the bylaws, while they were reconfiguring the bylaws, to mandate essentially quotas for women, for blacks, for others, to ensure minimum quotas. In other words, to ensure that people were actually represented, because that had historically been a problem at Pacifica. As progressive as it may be compared to, the rest of the American media, it was in fact, the black folks that were there had issues with the way they were treated because they were black. A lot of women producers had issues because of the way they were treated because they were women, et cetera. And so they sought to enshrine it. One group tried to enshrine in the bylaws that, these things would be addressed in practice. And the other group, the group that is now in control, or those that are still around that are now in control, were on the other side. They essentially nixed it so that it didn't happen. And so that politically there's definitely a schism that's fairly clear. If you look at the programming outside of Berkeley, I'll get to that in a second. Berkeley is different. The two sides are flipped for some reason that precedes my involvement. But if you go to Los Angeles, for example, Fernando Velasquez is a news producer there. He produces Informativa Pacifica. It's a Spanish language daily news program. He's a heavyweight guy. He is in touch daily with people at Telesur. He knows, like, the senior media people all over Central and South America. His political credentials are rock solid, and he does an excellent job as a news producer. He keeps getting marginalized and pushed around and abused there, I mean, they put him on at 5 o'clock in the morning. They put him on at 10 o'clock at night. They, you know, move it around so that it's almost impossible for him to build an audience. And they have issues that are voiced frequently about even having Spanish language, material on the air. That it somehow, is an impediment to their making more money. That's Fernando in L.A. Here in New York. When they came in, they started peeling off a number of the producers of color. They kept some, and in my opinion, to their shame, some others who are otherwise very progressive activists, rather than standing in solidarity with the ones that got canned, decided that staying on the air and dealing with their constituents was more important, found themselves isolated and got picked off one by one in the intervening 4 years up to now, where there's only a few left. But the most progressive producers here, the socialists, the lefties, the real anti-war activists, the Palestinian rights activists, the anti-racist activists, have been pushed either off the air completely or had their programs moved from 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning to like 10 o'clock at night when the audience is minuscule. And so there was a political agenda to all of this that has almost been fully expressed, and the final expression of it is pending now, where WBAI, which probably had the most progressive programming grid in the entire network, is now being put away for years now, out of reach, so that can't happen again.
So, Don, the ultimate question, what can people do to save what's left of Pacifica? Can it be saved, and should it be saved?
Yeah. There are a few things that can be done. Educate yourself about it. If don't take my word for it. There's a lot of material on the Internet, and a lot, some of it is fact-based. There's if you look at Vimeo and YouTube, for example, and look under my name, I have a lot of video from various producers telling the story. I can even tell the story. I have a recording of an interview I did with Cynthia McKinney, who, when they were having problems at Pacifica, actually applied for the job of executive director when they were taking applications, and they didn't even give her an interview. and this is somebody that ran a congressional office for 12 years that had a multimillion-dollar budget, probably as complex as running Pacifica, and because the actual running of Pacifica itself is just a small office and a small operation up in Berkeley, and her political credentials are, I would say, as good as anybody that's ever occupied that chair. They didn't even talk to her. But the thing that people need to do first is get information. So at YouTube YouTube.com/ Don DeBar, one word, DONDEBAR. Also, if you go to Vimeo, VIMEO.com, I did a long interview with Fernando Velasquez, who's been involved at Pacifica for decades and who has been around to see the history of it since the late 60s. He goes into the racial politics at Pacifica in considerable depth, in naming names and dates and places. And that's a very, very enlightening story indeed, and I think it's extremely relevant. What else they can do is give whatever the minimum donation is to Pacifica, wherever you are, and become a member, and then vote in the next election and, you know, vote for people that are standing on an anti-racist platform, on an anti-war platform, on an anti-capitalist platform, and who not only say it while they're running for the board, but are people that you know from out in the world.
And so obviously you feel like we should try and save it.
Well, the thing about radio is that just about anyone either has one or can have one. One of the problems with organizing a revolution, which some of us are trying to do, is that a lot of the folks that need to be organized are poor. And so when you're trying to do it on the Internet, a lot of those folks aren't there. They're not connected. They don't have computers, or they have computers, but they don't have high-speed Internet connection, or they have a high-speed Internet connection, but, you know, there's something that lacking. They're in the lower half of, you know, of the population in terms of resources. And so a lot of folks just listen to the radio, older people also. They don't use computers, a lot of us. I do, but a lot of my contemporaries don't. So radio is very valuable. Also, people listen to it when they're in their cars or when they're in transportation one way or another or at work. And so radio stations are unique still in the Internet age. The Pacifica radio stations, the five stations, and I can say for sure WBAI, they're very powerful signal, so people can hear them throughout the metropolitan areas that they're located in. WBAI's 99.5 is right in the middle of the dial. It's valuable because it's accessible to the people that we need to talk to. So I think it should be saved, and I think it can be, because anything can be done as long as we put our back into it.
Well, Don, would you like to give a plug for CPR Metro?
Yeah, we include you. Bernard White and I started, it'll be 2 years ago this December, with some other former producers and some current producers at Pacifica Radio, an Internet radio station called CPRMetro.org. It's CPRMetro.org, which stands for Community Progressive Radio, Metropolitan New York area. And we broadcast about 8 hours of original programming every day. We also host Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Pan-African Journal with Abiyami Ezekwe, Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash, Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and all those folks, and a lot of other stuff. I do a three-hour morning show every Monday through Friday. Bernard White does a three-hour middle-of-the-day show every Monday through Friday, and we have some music producers and some other arts and stuff programming, but very heavy political content and an awful lot of people actually working on stuff.
Perfect. So, Don DeBar, I will send you the recording of this interview.
I feel like I snuck through the mirror somehow.
It's creepy. It's like you know, you go to Starbucks on one corner and you look across the street and there's another Starbucks. You feel like you're in your vortex. Okay, Don DeBar, it was great to talk to you, and thank you for coming on and explaining this issue, important issue for us. And thank you for CPR Metro and helping Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. So we'll talk soon.
Thank you. And thank you for everything you do. Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, you too, Don. Talk soon.
All right, cool. Bye-bye. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
Our next guest today on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is Harvey Wasserman. Harvey is an American journalist, author, democracy activist, and advocate for renewable energy. He has been a strategist and organizer in the anti-nuclear movement in the United States for over 30 years. Harvey lives with his family in the Columbus, Ohio area.
Harvey Wasserman, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Cindy, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Well, it's great to finally have you on the show. And what caused me to reach out to you is what I feel is the most urgent issue, problem facing the entire planet today, and that's the continuing meltdown and just disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. And I was, you know, I know you, I know your work. I was drawn to call you or call on you today because of you're one of the people out there that is constantly reporting on what's happening, and I don't see it in the corporate media that much. You know, to us, it's such an urgent problem. Why do you think it doesn't get any coverage in the corporate so-called media?
Well, there's too much money invested in nuclear power, and they're very much afraid of alienating their advertisers and alienating the nuclear power industry, behind which there's just so much money. But I have to say, today, being Friday, Cindy, there's a major piece in the New York Times today by a guy named Martin Fackler, reporting from Japan, and it's actually a pretty powerful piece. I have people who are looking for coverage ongoing about Fukushima should come to the website I edit, nukefree.org, nukefree.org. I am constantly reading and publishing links to articles about Fukushima and other nuclear issues, as well as about green power. And I posted this piece today, which is a pretty frank and, of course, deeply disturbing report on what's happening with the water emissions, the contaminated water emissions at Fukushima. It's absolutely horrifying. And, you know, other reports I've been publishing are sort of anecdotal about the disappearance of all life, essentially, in the Pacific Ocean. And, you know, this has essentially become an apocalyptic event. It's gotten worse since it first began on March 11th, 2011. And we are now facing, as early as November 8th, the possibility that the Tokyo Electric Power Company, which is completely corrupt and is going to start bringing down fuel rods from Unit 4, where they're suspended 100 feet in the air. And this is absolutely terrifying. We have circulated a petition through nukefree.org and MoveOn to ask the United Nations to step in and lead the nations of the world to take over at Fukushima. We cannot have the fate of the Earth in the hands of a private corporation that has screwed up every step of the way, including building the plant in the first place. And engineering attempt at Fukushima to bring down these rods is the most difficult and most dangerous engineering action in the history of the world. You know, we have more than 13, it's actually more than 15,000 fuel rods up in the air.
Right.
In Fukushima, 100 feet in the air, a brilliant design by General Electric. And if even one of them fell to the ground and caught fire, enough radiation would be released that they would have to abandon the site and leave it essentially to chance. It would also, the radiation would also conceivably start to debilitate the electronic equipment on the site. And there are, as I say, there's over 1,500 fuel rods. We don't know the status of these fuel rods.
What I want to ask you is that you have, I believe the petition you have, petitioning the UN for international support, has over 100,000 signatures?
That's correct.
Have you had any response?
Well, we have not yet delivered the petitions. We are about to deliver them. We were going to deliver them on November 11th, but the company has pushed up their the alleged starting date to start removing the fuel rods. We think they may have done this in response to the reality of our petition. So we may deliver them on the 7th or earlier, but at this point in time, we have over 100,000 signatures at nukefree.org and 40,000 at rootsaction.org, calling for a global, international, possibly UN-led takeover of Fukushima, so that we can get actually the best scientists and engineers in the world working on it.
Well, you have a lot of contacts and connections. Have you been speaking to anybody at the UN or the U.S. government about this?
We don't have connections there. I'm relying on the internet and on radio shows like yours to get the word out.
Uh-huh.
We really need to build a grassroots demand, forceful demand, and successful to take over this site. We're starting to see some coverage. There was a big article that Reuters has put out about working conditions at Fukushima, which are horrible. They have a tremendous shortage of workers. I mean, we're probably going to need the world's military to move in at Fukushima and take it over. I mean, this is just, this is the equivalent of a nuclear war on the whole planet. We have hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water pouring into the Pacific every day. And this stuff does not go away. It spreads throughout the oceans of the world. It won't be just the Pacific. This is an apocalyptic event. And we just can't sit by and allow a private corporation that has to worry about its quarterly profits to do this. These are the people who are responsible for this catastrophe in the first place. This is like asking somebody who just shot another person to get down and try and cure them. I mean, it's insane, and it has to be dealt with. So this is what we're up against right now, and this is how we're working.
Well, Harvey, I was reading the article that was in the New York Times while I was having a technical issue with this interview, and the article is saying that there really is no danger because the Pacific Ocean will, that the Pacific Ocean is able to absorb that because it's so big, and then the radiation and the isotopes will dissipate. What's your take on that?
It's utter nonsense.
Right.
I mean, cesium, strontium, plutonium, iodine, the whole satanic brew of nuclear isotopes, radioactive isotopes that are pouring into the ocean will be with us forever, essentially. And they concentrate. They concentrate in the plankton. They concentrate in the vegetation. They concentrate in the smaller fish, which are eaten by the bigger fish, and so on. Those fish swim all over. We've had tuna in California, caught off the coast of California now, that has clearly detectable, tangible radiation from Fukushima. There will be measurable quantities of radiation washing up on the shores of California next year, if not already. The airborne radiation was measurable in California in less than a week after the accident. It's an apocalyptic event, and there's nothing to indicate that it's going to stop. The water is pouring down as it does naturally from the mountains through the site. We have three melted cores somewhere. They don't know where on the site. We've had hydrogen explosions. We have 11,000 fuel rods scattered around the site. I wish I could say it was a worst case scenario, but it's not even a worst case scenario. God forbid, we've already had two typhoons now Right. One typhoon last week, another one coming this week, which have poured, the last one poured 10 inches of water onto the site, which, of course, went pouring into the ocean. Who knows what the next one's going to do. At any moment, another earthquake could turn this place to rubble. We have two reactors in California, which are still operating, in an earthquake tsunami zone at Diablo Canyon near San Luis Obispo. We have three that are shut at San Onofre. Thank God they're shut. It was done by Citizen Action. But those that we still have spent fuel there. We have reactors all over the United States, all over the world, really, that are vulnerable to earthquakes. If the earthquake that caused the tsunami at Fukushima, if the epicenter had not been 120 kilometers, but 20 kilometers or 2 kilometers from the site, that place would be totally rubble. And you'd have six reactors that would just be irradiating. Nobody could go on the site. The water would be pouring through. We'd just be standing there watching helplessly. And that could happen. It could be happening as we speak to there, Fukushima, or any of the other 400 reactors still operating around the world. So this is really, I've been involved with this issue for 40 years now. Started in 1973, and this is the consummation of our worst nightmares. And it's just going on, and Great Britain now is talking of building more reactors.
Right.
You wonder if our species really was meant to survive when you look at this stuff.
Well, Harvey, we call for an international response. I have people tell me, well, Japan didn't ask for our help, but from what I understand, Abe has asked for the U.S. and Russia to help, but, Iraq didn't ask for our help, Afghanistan didn't ask for our help, and, we helped them to, ruining their countries. But Obama recently asked for $11 billion more dollars to upgrade our nuclear bombs. Instead of having all those resources going to destruction, it seems to me that, logically we should be putting it into Fukushima to contain that. But at this point, what can be done, even if the entire international community focused its resources and energy there?
Well, the first thing we can do is get those fuel rods down to the ground and start to, as best we can, to clean up the place. There has to be a ditch dug between the mountains and the reactors. At this point, the water has to be dealt with. They've got 1,000 tanks on the site there, every one of which would come crumbling down, holding, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water. They would all come crashing down if there's an earthquake, so that water has to be gotten out of there somehow. And, we read in the Reuters article today that, the labor conditions, are abominable. And in fact, Tokyo Electric Power cut wages for workers after the accident.
Right.
Because, they have to show a profit. So we are, really in a sorry state here. This is a horrifying situation. And so what we need to do is petition the UN, petition the American government, call the Japanese, five former prime ministers of Japan now have come out and said that they want an end to nuclear power. All of them were at one point or another pro-nuclear. And, we just have to continue doing what we've been doing all these years and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But the nations of the world, the people of the world are going to have to keep their eyes on Fukushima every day now. This is really, Chernobyl was the worst thing that ever happened on this planet. And prior to that, the bomb tests, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but now this has transcended them. This is an ongoing hemorrhage of the life force of the human race. There's no other way to put it. And we have to focus all our attention on Fukushima and hopefully find some kind of solution to stop this. The only good news is that all the other reactors in Japan are shut right now, and I don't think they'll reopen. There were 54 operating when Fukushima happened. They're all shut. And this did slow down the Chinese. It certainly was a turning point for the Germans. We can move ahead, but what's happening on a daily basis at Fukushima is catastrophic. And it's really, I'm almost at a loss, but we just have to continue to push as hard as we can to get the forces of the world in there. And I really think that the global militaries have to be sent in, and all the scientists and engineers with any expertise in this at all have to be focused on this. We cannot let a private utility company or even a single country with its vested interests be in charge of a situation that could kill us all, basically.
And yet we still have the people who are insisting that nuclear power is safe because, there's been X amount of deaths for X amount of wattage that it has produced. And I recently saw a conversation that Michael Moore had with the filmmaker of Pandora's Promise, and they were basically just totally ragging on and making fun of us activists who are still anti-nuke, like we're dinosaurs or something.
Yeah, well, shame on them. Really, shame on them. But we don't have time for that. This is a tangible event. The former ambassador from Japan to Switzerland wrote me, and basically he has been quoted. This transcends the debate over nuclear power. This is something that absolutely is happening moment to moment, that is killing us all. And I really think that we just have to focus on whatever we can do at Fukushima to alleviate this situation. It is absolutely catastrophic. And we did have, anecdotal evidence sometimes has its weight. There was a piece that went around the internet from a sailor who sailed from Japan and sailed out 3,000 miles and saw nothing alive.
Right.
And there are reports now, I put this one up at nukefeed.org, the disappearance of sea lions and the bleeding fish and the salmon count is down. This is all our worst nightmares here. And it's not even the worst that could happen. So we've been winning great victories against nuclear power plants, and renewables are coming on, and that debate has really shifted in the direction of green power, with Germany going green. Solar and wind are just booming ahead, but we have an immediate, we're bleeding on the floor here.
And I just
have to focus all our energies on whatever we can do to stop this situation at Fukushima. It is beyond horrifying, and it could get worse. I mean, the thing about it is this happened 2.5 years ago, and here we are. With a scenario, many, many different scenarios that can make the whole thing worse. If they screw up on this bring down of the fuel, if there are problems with water, loss of power, if the radiation levels go up at the site, which they easily could do, they're going to run out of space to store the radioactive water. They've had a typhoon. There could be an earthquake. We just are really on a high wire here. And it's devastating. So people should go to nukefree.org, sign the petition, call whoever you can call, and get the focus on this catastrophe as it's happening.
So, Harvey, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and I apologize for the technical difficulties I had. Like I told you via email, it never happens that I have such technical difficulties 2 weeks in a row, and, you know, I'm not going to assign any, you know, conspiracy to that, but I think it's weird. And we will post the nukefree.org and the petition on the website and the newsletter again this week. And like I said, people, get on the phone, get into the streets, demand action on this, because we need to put aside what other things now and really get the international attention and resources focused on Fukushima.
I also have a YouTube, Cindy, you can link to from EON, E-O-N, or you can just Google Harvey Wasserman Fukushima YouTube. It's had almost 20,000 views. It kind of lays out the technical aspect of what we can expect here with this bring down of fuel at Unit 4.
It's like a nightmare Hollywood movie happening.
It wouldn't be credible if it was a Hollywood
movie. In real time, just terrifying.
If it was a Hollywood movie, it would be deemed not credible. All the 40 years I've been doing this, no one ever talked about a triple meltdown. You know, everybody said, well, what if a nuclear plant melts down? We never thought about three or four explosions. All these decades, the nuclear industry said a nuclear reactor can't explode. And now we've had five of them explode. Fukushima 1, 2, 3, 4, and Chernobyl. Very, very close. So this is really, really a bad, bad dream, and we've got to figure out how to respond now. We're really being pushed. Our species is being pushed to the limit.
Well, Harvey Wasserman, nukefree.org, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we'll keep hammering this, and it is our focus here. My focus and the focus at the Soapbox. So, again, thank you so much, Harvey, and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Cindy. Anytime.
Well, that's the show for today. Our interview with Don was very informative, and I agree that alternative sources of media should be preserved, and we should have our say and our voice there too. That's why we have Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. And of course, Harvey's interview was pretty frightening. It's not too late yet. I can't say it's never too late, because we might get to that point, but not if we get in the streets, get on our phones, get on any way we can and demand that the international community contain Fukushima. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar. He was my guest, and he's going to put this show together for us, or he did put this show together for us. I'd like to thank my other guest, Harvey Wasserman, and you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.